morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin podcast, the weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to the coaching staff, episode number 124. Tony and I talked a week ago. It was 82, then it was 75, and then I lost 2 days of school because of a blizzard, and now it's 60 and windy, and welcome to the Midwest in the spring. You gotta love it. Climate change is upon us and everything here. Tony, how you doing, my friend?
Just trying to figure out this weather. Like you said, Marty, it's one day, you know, you got... we're heading towards summer, and the next day you're okay. We're at spring. Yeah. That makes sense because it's that time of the year.
Yeah,
and then like you said, then we get blizzard and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, I think we're having some issues with the weather making up its mind, but it is what it is. But 50s and windy, so similar to what you have out there.
Yeah, yep. We are at episode 124 here. Wow, Tony, we've got a lineup, especially of baseball players. The uniform number 24 here. I'm just going to go through the and I all but one of them were outfielders. Ricky Henderson, may he rest in peace. Yeah, not too bad. Yeah, Manny Ramirez. Other than Ryne Sandberg, in the running for second of my favorite players as a childhood baller in the sandlots of Sheldon, Iowa. It would be a close, depending on the day, between Barry Larkin and Ken Griffey Jr. Ken Griffey Jr., number 24. Say Hey, Willie Mays. Not Willie Mays Hayes, just Willie Mays.
Hayes was better.
Yeah, Hayes was better. Every time you pop one into the air, Hayes, you owe me 50 push-ups.
Did you ever hear that they always shot the scenes of him running in slow motion because Wesley Snipes is actually really slow? So this gave the appearance anyway that Hayes was fast.
Yes, I did. I did hear that too. What a great movie. Miguel Cabrera, the recently retired Miguel Cabrera. Barry Bonds, number 24. A couple of defensive backs here, Charles Woodson and Darryl Revis, Revis Island, number 24 here. A great lineup of baseballers and defensive backs. I've got six number 24s here, Tony, in basketball.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with my man, Kobe Bean Bryant.
Yeah. Yeah, I had written down just Kobe, but I made sure I put Bryant behind it to make sure that I got that one right. So
yeah. I want to say, was Bob Lanier, was he 24?
He was 16.
Like I said, crud. Because Clyde Drexler would have been 22, right?
Yep. Let's see here.
Moses.
Yes. That was his Houston Rockets number, 24.
Okay. He was two at the 60s, right?
Yep. The most hated player of the 60s and 70s.
Most hated 60s and 70s. See, that would be easy if it was 80s. It would be Bill Lane Beer. 60s and 70s.
ABA and NBA player. One in NBA, Barry? Rick Barry. There you are. Legendary Boston Celtics shooting guard from the 1960s. Late 50s and 60s.
The Celtics? I drawn a blank.
Sam Jones. Yeah. Have you seen... the show Celtics City on HBO Max, whatever it's called. It is really, really good. My daughter, she's not a basketball fan, but she loves basketball documentaries. And so we're watching it together. I have to let it sit on the DVR till she comes home for a weekend or something like that. And there's only three episodes so far. I think it's a 9-part episode, or it's a 9-part series. And it's really, really good, Tony. It's really good. If you get a chance, watch it, check it out. So,
okay.
Let's see here. Two more left. Broke the hardship rule, allowing players to come in to the pros as underclassmen. I think he might
be David Thompson, wasn't he?
No. I think he played at the University of Iowa, actually. Or he was supposed to. Eventually ended up with...
Not Don Nelson,
no. Want me to help you out? Spencer Haywood.
Okay.
Yeah. Made the Olympic team in 68. Oh, he was from the University of Detroit. Sorry, University of Detroit. So, last one. Underrated player of the 80s and the 90s. The best in-game dunk of our teenage years. Also, with the greatest middle part in NBA history. Yes, it is. Mr. Tom Chambers, you are correct.
That dunk was incredible.
Yes, it was. I believe it was on Mark Jackson. And he put that knee right in his chest. Yes.
It was almost like his chest was at the rim.
Yes.
I couldn't believe he jumped that high.
Yeah. I think I was watching that live when it happened. Like it was on the old, this is like when the NBA was on USA Network or something like that. And I remember it was in our kitchen in the house that I grew up in. So, you know, anybody that I grew up with, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I just went and just run around. Oh my gosh. Oh, can you believe that's the greatest dunk ever. And so I, you know, I had a couple of those myself in my playing career on the Nerf hoop, Tony. So, Tom Chambers. So Kobe Bryant, Moses Malone, Rick Barry, Sam Jones, Spencer Haywood, and Tom Chambers. That's pretty good. That's pretty good six-man rotation. Yeah, you'd win some games. So we are here this week to talk about lessons learned from the NCAA tournament, some things in our observations after watching games here the last few days. I apologize to Carla on Sunday or Monday last week. I really apologize for all the basketball that's going to be on over the next 3 weeks here. But it's been an interesting go. Tony, let's just general observations of the tournament so far. What have you thought of the madness on both genders so far?
You know, as I watch it, you know, with the exception of the Duke men, the one thing I think that is a premium that a lot of emphasis is on and needs to be on is the importance of tournament experience. I mean, if you go through and take a look, I mean, rosters are so fluid nowadays. And you take a look at it, you know, obviously there's the Cooper Flags and you know, the Derrick Queens and players like that, that the McDonald's, all Americans.
Yeah.
But you take a look, it's pretty much juniors and seniors from other rosters that they get plucked from. And I just think the importance of tournament experience is a huge, huge premium. Unless you come across, you know, your McDonald's all Americans, they're going to be a top five pick in the NBA draft that next year. But I don't think you can put enough emphasis on experience.
You got to have those scars, Tony. You know, you got to have, like you said, that experience, understanding the bright lights and everything changes. You know, you've got now they're doing halftime interviews with players and, you know, different stuff like that. And you may think, well, what's the big deal? It's a big deal because it's not normal. It's not what you normally do. I mean, you know, think of if you got to the state tournament and all of a sudden they started grabbing your kids at halftime as you're going back on the floor. Hey, we need Billy for a halftime interview here or whatever. Those things matter. It's kind of like teams going to the Super Bowl for the first time and understanding, okay, this is the pregame. This is how much this lasts. This is all the interviews we're going to have to do, this, that, and the other thing. Okay, now we're at halftime. We've got this completely different halftime with these performers and all this other stuff. And I think the production of the NCAA tournament has changed that as well. So not only do you need that experience off the floor, but you on the floor, but you need that experience off the floor as well. I think that helps you with that. So I agree, though, Tony. Having those scars, having those upperclassmen, you wanna get old, you know, and that's where the transfer portal is gonna play into things, you know. You know, your Dukes are going to pick up your Cooper Flags, or your Maryland has the Queen kid, and you know, that type of stuff. But you take a look at like Rutgers; they got two potential top five picks, and they're not even in the tournament. You need old players. You need old players, and along with that, Tony, you need some depth. You need some depth. And I've said this on multiple times on multiple pods, but depth, depth, depth. It's hard to win in the tournament with only six guys, or ladies. You need seven, eight, sometimes nine. You get in foul trouble. You play it a little bit more conservatively. Now, I think you take a look at a team like St. John's. They had maybe too much depth, and I think Patino, you know, and again, pretty simple. You got to make shots too. I think at one point they were 4 of 16 on layups in that game against Arkansas. But depth is another big one, along with experience. It's gonna pay off. It's gonna pay off. So
Because that experience thing you were talking about too. I know, like with Drake, obviously a story out of Iowa, they went and got kids at the Division II level. And, you know, I think as we sit there and take a look at that, you know, do you want a kid who's done it and had success and experience and numbers to back it up at the Division I level? Or do you want to roll the dice with a freshman coming in from the high school ranks who you might not know as much about? And so that's also something that's become more and more, like you said, in the NIL age that we're in.
Yeah. I think we are almost headed to a system, Tony, where your low mid majors and low majors, and to a degree your mid majors or whatever, unless you are the top 25 type of player, top 20 type of player, more and more coaches are going to go towards, why would I spend a ton of time recruiting this kid out of high school where I can let him go here, and if he develops there in a couple of years, we'll offer him X amount of NIL money and we'll get him here anyway, and our risk is minimized, you know, because, you know, just as well as I do, if I've always thought, you know, we'll just use a simple number to put it even. Let's say you bring in six freshmen. Out of those six freshmen, it was always kind of my experience that three of them are going to kind of live up to expectations or close to their expectations or even exceed their expectations. But usually two or three of those six are not going to, you know, something's going to happen, whether that's personal, whether it's they decide to play another sport, you know, whatever it may be. And I think more and more coaches are going to kind of go that route. You're going to have your outliers here and there, but I think that's the system we're headed towards. What do you think?
Yeah, I could see a deal where it's a salary cap thing or it's a tiered system.
Yeah.
And so I definitely could see that happening sooner rather than later because, you know, Marty, it's becoming like the Wild West with college athletics and paying the players and stuff like that. I mean, when people are willing to stay in college rather than to roll the dice to go to the professional ranks because they can make more money in college, you might have a system that's need of some tweaking.
Yeah, you got guys that are, I could stay here in school and make $500,000 and ride charter jets and play in front of these great crowds, or I could go to the D League and make $50,000-$75,000 and play in front of at best 1,000 people and do this and that. I mean, that's what we're headed towards, right?
It sure seems like,
yeah. Now, of course, the appeal is if you can do it in the G League, then you get the call up to the NBA level, and that's, you know, that's every kid's dream, you know, even mine while I was dunking in the toy room at 602 Sixth Avenue, imitating that Tom Chambers dunk. But, you know, I told my brother, just stand right here. Just stand. No, I'm just kidding. I didn't really, more than once. But yeah, I think that's why we might be heading to that though. Couple of things that I noticed with coaches, and you mentioned Drake, Tony. I think it's a good time to talk about this guy, Ben McCollum. confidence in players and the importance of controlling tempo. And boy, did they do that against Missouri. They've done it all year. It's just everybody saw it on the big stage. But, you know, confidence in your players. I think I saw something where Drake led the country in possessions that went under 5 seconds on the shot clock on offense.
They, a significant margin. Yeah. Was it by like 5 or 10?
Yeah, yeah. It was like 389, and the next closest one was like 260 or something like that. So it was literally like 130 more than the next closest team, 130, 140. You know, good history teacher math there. So controlling tempo and then giving confidence in your players to make plays at the end of the shot clock, at the end of games. And boy, McCollum was the master manipulator of those situations.
I think his philosophy was, if you can get a team to have to play good, hard defense and run a bunch of different actions at them, they're going to break down after 25 seconds. And once you make them sit in a stance that long, that kind of saps some things in the offensive end too. But yeah, I mean, he's a maestro. He just did a fantastic job with that. And the thing that's always interesting to me, because I think people are looking at it going, oh man, I don't know how that would translate to a Power Four school. You know, he didn't do that at Northwest Missouri State. They play different. He takes the system and he fits the players. But when you're Drake and you're playing Missouri and you're playing Texas Tech, and I'm not trying to be mean, but you're out-athleted, you're going to have to do something to make up for that. And I thought he had great game plans in both games. And I give Texas Tech credit, too, because of the fact that the first game they took almost 50 threes as a team, and then the next game they knew where their advantage was. It was inside, and they pounded the ball inside.
Yep.
And the Toppin kid, and I can't remember the other post kid's name right now, but they both had middle 20s, and they did a great job of playing where they had the advantage at.
It was two outstanding coaching jobs by two outstanding young coaches in Texas Tech and Drake, in both of their wins in that way, you know, and again, adjusting that game plan, having that flexibility. For the second time tonight, Tony, I was going to say something. Now I forget what it was. Had to do with Drake. Blah, blah. Okay, I'm going to move on anyway. I don't want people to be bored with that. But, you know, controlling that tempo, you know, again, adapting. Oh, you know, one of the things that Drake does, and I think it's something that coaches need to think about, you know, McCollum, in this era of pace and space and shooting threes and free-flowing offenses and different things like that. And I'm a fan of that, you know, and that's what I liked, you know, when I was coaching. But he's zigging while everybody else is zagging. And when you're preparing for 25 different opponents that kind of do a lot of the same principles, and then the Drake team comes along where they're like, yeah, we're going to have to defend for 27 seconds every stinking possession, fellas. We haven't had to do that all year against anybody. That's a hard adjustment too. And if you're used to doing that, whether it was like the old Oklahoma wishbone or when Chip Kelly was the first one to do the spread, the run, not run and shoot, but the spread offense, the spread option and that type of stuff. That's really, really hard to prepare for. And that gives you a strategic advantage as well. So, you know, I think that's something else we could take from McCollum here.
Yeah. And everybody talks about how the teams that are successful, everybody copies them. Mm-hmm. And I think those that maybe don't have the same resources, rather than being that copycat, do something so diametrically different that it's really hard to prepare for. Because in our situation here, Marty, when John came into the league here for the guys, not many teams switched everything. Yeah. And all of a sudden, he's switching everything. And he caught him off guard. He's been at the state tournament multiple times, and now guess what almost everybody in our league does? Oh, they switch everything.
There's a heck of a lot more replicators than there are innovators out there, Tony, and I would include myself in the replicating category strongly, my friend.
Me too. Yeah. I don't have many original unique ideas, as you obviously know.
Coaches, I am really excited to announce this year's lineup for our 5th annual Pen and a Napkin Coaches Clinic. This year's clinic date is Saturday, April the 12th. It's going to take place at Mary R. Queen Gymnasium, located at 3405 South 119th Street here in Omaha. We've got 3 on-court demonstrators. Andy King, the head boys basketball coach at Elkhorn North High School, will get the day started with his clinic on developing your team through 5-on-5 controlled scrimmages. Jody Steyer, my good friend from Iowa State University, the associate head coach at Iowa State with the women's basketball team, is going to talk about individual player development in small group settings. Jamie Smith, the head girls basketball coach at Solon High School in Iowa, one of the best I've ever seen, teach about shooting fundamentals, is going to talk to us about how to put together a great shooting workout for your players. Coach Smith won a state championship last year at the Class 3A level in Iowa. Those are 3 on-court demonstrators. Then we're going to have 3 off-court demonstrators. Our lunch keynote speaker is my guy Raz Vanderloo, the head boys basketball coach at Sioux City East High School. And also Raz is very involved with USA Basketball. I'm just going to let Raz cook. He's going to talk to us just with a basketball smorgasbord of topics about what Raz wants to talk about that day. Then we're going to have 2 smaller breakout sessions. Lucas Dollinghouse, the head boys basketball coach at Johnson Brock here in high school, highly successful program. He's also an administrator, and he's going to talk about coaching through an administrator's eyes along with some other things. Our other breakout session is weekday Wade Coulter, the head girls basketball coach at Gretna East High School, and he's going to talk about building a pressure defensive system. One of the great things about the Pen and a Napkin Clinic is, in addition to our presenters, we also have 2 designated breakout sessions where you will get the opportunity to discuss various topics with other coaches attending the clinic. These sessions are a great way to pick the brains of your peers at the clinic, and it's one of the most enjoyable points of our annual clinic. And then, hey, after a long day of learning about hoops, it's time to kick back and relax. We're going to have an optional post-clinic social at Wine 121. It's right down the street from Mary R. Queen, about a mile, mile and a half down the road. I want to thank my friend TK, Tom Crable, for opening his doors to the clinic again. It's just $15 per coach for anybody that wants to join us there. Our Pen and a Napkin Clinic is one of the most affordable clinics in America. I mean, it is really, really, really affordable. You're going to get over 7 hours worth of information. That's $60 for a coach. If you're just a singular coach that wants to come up and check it out, it's $60 a coach. If you bring yourself and another coach from your staff, it's $110. 3 coaches from your staff, $150. If you bring 4 or more coaches from your staff, it is only $45 per coach. We've got a sliding scale. It's all about getting better at an affordable price. So if you are interested in signing up for our Pen and a Napkin Clinic, look to the flyer on Twitter and mail it in. You can scan it in. You can do all those different things, or you can DM me on Twitter, or you can email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Registrations are due by Thursday, April the 10th, 2025. Coaches, do not miss out on one of the best coaching clinics in America. Let's. What's another thing that you've observed here from the tournament, Tony?
I think you go through and you take a look at the impact of coaching and leadership. I think that's a big one. And here's what I mean by that, Marty. You know, in today's world, there's not a lot of loyalty. It's which school is willing to pay you the most money, mm-hmm. as far as the NIL, that whole transfer thing, you know, that type of thing. But it's really, really hard to undervalue that leadership and coaching side of things. You cited 2 really good examples, Coach McGuire at Texas Tech, and then taking a look at McCollum at Drake. But you could sit there and go through. Todd Golden at Florida has done an amazing job. You know, I know UConn got beat today, and people like to take shots at Danny Hurley, and sometimes deservedly so. But to have the year they had, and then to push one of, if not the best teams in the country with Florida today, says a lot about Danny Hurley and his leadership there at UConn. You know, and another one that I think that kind of gets underappreciated at times too is John Shire. you know, you catch various clips on X about John Shire and what he says. You know, I was watching one where they, I think they were down at halftime in the ACC tournament, and he, I wouldn't necessarily say read him the riot act, but he got on him, you know, and these are five-star McDonald's All-Americans, and he's got some grad transfers, and he's got, you know, some guys on there as well with experience, but that experience too, not just the coaching, but those guards on the floor. You know, I go back yesterday, Ejiofor with St. John's, their leading scorer was having a rough day, and he was really trying to help pick him up and help St. John's get back in that game. Now, don't get me wrong, they ended up getting beat by Coach Cal in Arkansas, and granted, Coach Cal, you know, his name's coming back on the upswing with what he's done at Arkansas. Mark Pope replaced him at Kentucky, who knocked out Illinois today. I mean, just that leadership from and coaching this time of the year is so very, very evident, and those are the teams that normally move on as the tournament advances.
Yeah, you got to be able to coach your team. You know, if I were to get back into it as a head coach, you know, one of the first questions, if not the first question I would ask my team, are you coachable? Are you coachable? Are you going to do you really want to hear the truth? And you could see in those clips with Patino, with Shire, those kids are coachable and they want to hear the truth. They might not like what they hear, but they would rather hear it than not hear it. And you and I have both done this, you know, we are, of course, seasoned and experienced, Tony. We have had teams where we have had players, and especially if your best players aren't coachable, you're in trouble. You're done. And you can't, it's just not going to function. It's just not going to be successful. And so you've got to have, you know, so I think if I were to take over a job again, that would maybe be my first question that I would have for my players. Are you coachable? Can you handle me telling you the truth? Because I'm going to tell you the truth one way or another. How you handle that truth is going to determine how successful we are. And seeing that experience, seeing those clips of Shire and Patino, you know, Patino benched the one kid, the Big East player of the year, because he was, you know, was 3 of 17 and he was letting his offense affect his defense and different stuff like that. So, yeah, I agree with you, Tony. I love that observation. I love that point. You know, it's really, really important to have that strong, strong leadership. So,
and I think Matt Painter is another one who's underappreciated.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He is. You know, everybody was kind of on the McNeese bandwagon, and you know, he kind of came in and said, "Ah, not so fast, my friend."
Molly Miller on the women's side is another rising star. She just took the Arizona State job. She's going to do big things there. I was listening to a clip of her about defense, and man, she's really, really good.
Yeah, she was on point with that. Yeah, that's a interesting one there too. So, here's another thing that I've seen. You gotta have dudes or dudettes that can put the ball in the basket. You've got to have scorers. You've got to have talent. A lot of times it's not about the X's and O's. It's about the Jills and the Joes. And you've got to have that, that difference making talent. And those players that can take things, as Key would say, I can't remember if it's Key or Peel, to a whole nother level. You know, I won't try to do a bad impression there. So, but we saw that as an example. You know, St. John's played with such grit, such tenacity, such effort, such intensity all season long. But ultimately, they just didn't have enough offense to carry them. And they didn't have that guy. And it's hard to find that guy, Tony. I'm not saying, hey, just find a guy that can, or a gal that can put the ball in the basket. It's hard. It's really hard. They are the coin of the realm. They are the difference makers. But you really, really need to have that. Can you win a game? Yeah, you can win a game. Maybe even two. But it's hard to go on a deep, deep run without having a dude or a dudette that is just the dude or the dudette that can just put the ball in the basket more than almost everybody else?
That's probably been my biggest evolution as a coach. I love defense, don't get me wrong, still do. But I used to believe that, hey, defense wins championship, defense wins games, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know how many years ago it was, but that's been my biggest change, is the fact that offense wins the game. Don't get me wrong, defense is going to determine by how much, but offense wins the game. And that's probably been my biggest change.
Mm-hmm. Yep. What else you got, buddy?
You know, another one, and this is, I don't know if I would necessarily put this in the same categories as the others, but the other one is, Marty, I just really love tournament basketball. And what I mean by that is this. Don't get me wrong, I love the NBA too, but you cannot replace this one game thing. If you win, you survive and you go on. I mean, I'm sure if St. John's played Arkansas seven times, it might go seven games. Maybe it goes five or six. I don't know. But I believe that St. John's wins that series. But because it was a one-game shootout, there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
You know, I just love the potential for an upset in this whole thing. And there are other ones. I mean, I could give the South Dakota State women their props as well.
Yep.
Oregon knocked off Vanderbilt and the women's side of things too.
Yeah.
But there is nothing like this with a one game. Hey, it's all here. You're trying to get 40 more minutes. I just love that. And some people thrive in those pressure situations. You know, pressure makes diamonds type of thing.
Yeah.
And it causes other players, sometimes even the most valuable players in their league during the regular season, to melt down.
You know, that's advice that I give to a lot of coaches. When they ask about this, or that, you know, I'll be talking to a buddy before the state tournament. You know, it's going to be a tough go, you know, with this, hey, it's not a seven game series. You just got to win 32 minutes. You don't have to win 32 minutes times four times or 40 minutes times four times or whatever it may. You just got to win one 32 minute set, you know, so just concentrate on, you know, again, is stuff you do in the regular season, you know, win more 4-minute segments than the other team wins, or 2-minute segments, or whatever it may be. But I agree with you, Tony. You know, right now we're recording this on Sunday evening. You know, Colorado State is giving Maryland everything that they could ask for. I think New Mexico is going to be competitive against Michigan State tonight. It's what makes it great. You know, again, I go back to that St. John's Arkansas game, the urgency in that crowd, because the St. John's crowd was just so hungry to make a deep run. They wanted to keep this dream season going. And you and I have both been there, Tony. It's such a high. Those wins, it's like a drug. It's like a drug, and it is such a great, great feeling. And you're happy. You're happy for your kids more than anything else. You know that we get to keep going. We get to keep playing. You know all that stuff. So, I agree with you there. In order to get there, a couple of things that I've got. I got one or two things left, Tony. I've really noticed, the teams that are really, really aggressive with their perimeter defense have had some success here. Houston, Auburn, Ole Miss is up on Iowa State right now. Connecticut has won a couple of back-to-back championships with physical perimeter defense. Now, that's a very, very fine line, because if you get the wrong set of officials, you can get a call for a lot of cheap fouls, and that can turn things around very quickly. You know, South Carolina has been very successful with that. And at times, I think when I was coaching Tony, I think we could have been more physical on the perimeter than the way I coached the kids, but I didn't want us to pick up cheap fouls either. I would rather you know, just keep everything in front of us instead of trying to disrupt things too much. But I think as these better and more skilled players come about, I think the officials are allowing for some more physicality out on the perimeter, and those teams have had some success. And so that might be something that coaches might be looking at is in the replication part of what they're seeing on TV here these next couple of weeks, that might be something that they may look at.
Let me ask you this, maybe two parts to it.
Okay.
Do you think that they call it tight, say November, December, and then as the season goes on, they get tired of calling it?
Yep.
And the whistle gets swallowed a little bit more per se?
Yep. Oh yeah, without a doubt. How many years did you go to, you know, back when we used to have coaches meetings or officiating meetings, and you have to, you know, yes, I did take, I was at this meeting, and you know, you fill out your form or whatever, you know, and they'd all, we're going to enforce a hand check, we're going to do this, you know, and then, okay. And I remember one year they made this big hullabaloo of hand checks, and we're going to cut down on physicality. And that was the whole thing. That's all we heard all summer.
Freedom of movement.
All fall. Yeah. Freedom of movement. And we played in our scrimmage game, and it's been long enough. I can say who it was with and who it was against, but I was at Scott, and we played against Millard North. They're coached by a guy named Scott Persigal, and Scott's a good guy. I like Scott, but he was definitely, you know, we're going to foul you 100 times, and we bet you're only going to call it 20, you know, one of those type of things. And we came out in this, and okay, you know, they've been saying freedom of movement, this, that, and the other thing. And I mean, they beat the you-know-what out of us, and they didn't call a thing. And I talked to one of the officials after the game, and he's like, well, you know, what'd you think? And I'm like, I'm going to be honest with you, I'm not happy. See, you guys have been talking for 6 months about how you're going to not allow that. And then they just beat the holy bleepity bleepity bleep out of us out there for 32 minutes. What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to go tell my team when I've been teaching them for 2.5 weeks to, this is the way we got to play defense because this is the way they're going to officiate it. And then you just allowed that bloodbath to happen. And yeah, he kind of, yeah, you're probably right. You know, like, well, that does us no good now, you know, but, and I mean, it was just an exhibition game. It didn't go on the record or the resume or anything like that. But yeah, I wholeheartedly agree that, you know, especially like at this level, at the high division one level, how many times watch a game and you'll see a guy that's officiating a game, let's say TCU against Iowa State in the Big 12, and then the next night he's doing St. John's versus Connecticut, and then the night after that he's doing Minnesota against Iowa in the Big 10. Boom, boom, boom. Those guys get tired. They lose their positioning. They lose their, and these are usually, a lot of these guys are older gentlemen. They're in their 50s and lower 60s. Yeah, they're not in position. They get lazy. They get tired of getting chirped at. You know what I mean? Absolutely. Absolutely. 1,000%. I sorry, let me jump off that soapbox.
Well, you're good, because my next question that I want to go to is, do you notice any difference in officiating between the men and women's college game?
Not as much as they're used. I think they're letting the women play more physically. I think the officiating has gotten much better in the women's game. No official is going to be perfect. And I'm always going to have a soft spot, because my dad was an official for a long time, Tony. I think I've told you that before. So I'm always going to have a soft spot for officials and what they're trying to do. You know, but I think that they're letting the women play more physically than they did in the past, in my opinion. What do you think?
I think they are letting them play more than what they have in the past, but there still is a little bit of a difference. It's not like it used to be, but there still is a little bit of a difference, in my opinion. And again, I am not the greatest, you know, evaluator of officials by any means, but it just seems like flipping back and forth between the games a little bit, it seems like there's still a little bit of a difference, but it is becoming more negligible.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What else you got, Tony? I got maybe one more thing.
Yeah, this is my last one too. I think the thing that I've noticed a lot, Marty, to be honest with you, is the importance of getting off to a really good start. Now, don't get me wrong, I still understand it's a 40-minute game, but if you can get off to a good start, especially as an underdog, I think that really, really helps you get that belief. Hey, we can do this. You know, you go through and you take a look at a variety of games out there. I'm thinking specifically of the Kentucky Liberty game. Kentucky got up 17 on them and was able to hold on for dear life. But if they had not got off to that good start, who knows where that thing would have went second half for them. But I put the importance of early game management and getting off to a good start is so very, very important, both in the men's and women's game. Playing from the lead, getting your kids to relax and just play basketball, I think is so, so very, very important.
Yeah, I'm going to piggyback and kind of build on that, Tony, is when you get into these games, you know, here we're talking about the Division I tournament, you're coming off, you know, Kennedy's coming off of a state tournament. I think along with that, it's good to get off to that great start. Who was it? Was it Gonzaga was ahead of Georgia like 25-3 or some crazy number like that? And that's the extreme, you know, because I think if they played that game 100 times, it would never happen that way again. But managing those ups and downs, not getting too high, not getting too low. Every team is good, even, you know, Colorado State is up 3 on Maryland with 5 minutes left to go right now. They're good. Arkansas is playing much better in the last month. They're good. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, New Mexico, they're good. And, you know, so I think that, you know, managing those ups and downs, staying steady, I think is the, and not getting frustrated with officiating or not getting frustrated with your players or that type of thing. You know, you've just got to stay as steady as you can. The bigger the game, the steadier you have to be, I think. And so that's another thing that, you know, a lot of times, I'm not saying the game is going to be exactly won or lost because a coach stays steady or doesn't stay steady, but I think you're more likely to win than you are to lose the steadier that you are, if that makes sense.
100%. Because sometimes you can have that meltdown and it sparks your team or whatever, maybe get a T or whatever the case may be. But that's the exception. That's not the rule.
Yeah. Meltdowns are for middle of January in the dog days to get your team going and to show them a sense of urgency. Meltdowns should not be for March, in my opinion. You know, yeah, maybe I'll copyright that phrase. No meltdowns in March, Tony. Right. Yeah. Hey, there we go. We could trademark that. How about that?
There you go.
Yeah. Coaches are absolutely loving our taking over a new program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching. And during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Speaking of trademarking, Tony, do you know which band from the continent across the ocean from us to the east has perhaps the greatest trademark of them all?
Europe.
Tony, you have trivia this week. What do you have for me, my friend?
All righty. So John Calipari, whose name was kind of drugged through the mud the past few years, Kentucky flaming out early and then leaving Kentucky the way that went down and so on and so forth, has kind of enjoyed a little bit of a career renaissance after starting off 0-5 in the SEC. He now has his young Arkansas Razorback team in the Sweet 16. And Marty, this is the fourth team that he has taken to the Sweet 16 and there has only been one other coach who has done that, what NCAA men's coach also has taken four teams to the Sweet 16?
Eddie Sutton.
Great guess, but not Eddie Sutton. A little bit more modern.
Rick Barnes.
A little later than Rick Barnes, but another really good guess.
God.
Would you like a hint?
I don't know, Clark. Yeah, sure.
His son recently just got fired.
Why am I drawing a blank? I you got me.
Lon Kruger.
Oh, yes. Let's see here. K-State, Florida, UNLV, and Oklahoma. Yeah, Oklahoma. Yes, Lon Kruger. Yes. And his son was at UNLV as well.
Got Kevin, if I remember correctly.
Yes, yes. All right. Wow. That's a good question. That was a fair good question, Tony. That was solid stuff. In fact, I say,
thank you, Marty.
How about that?
That was a great trivia question. Mel Allen even thinks so. So,
thank you, Mel.
Yeah, thank you, Mel. Speaking of Mel Allen, speaking of all of this, we have a little segment we haven't used for a while. Tony, are you ready?
Ready.
Kids, we want to eat. Arby's, we have the meats.
We have some folks that are going to be buying us some Arby's, Tony. Tis the season that Arby's will be ours. Darren DeVries, hired by Indiana. Will Wade to North Carolina State. Sean Miller looks like he is on his way to Texas. And on the women's side, Kelly Harper. To Missouri, Columbia, Missouri. Tony, out of these four, who has the best chance at sustained success?
This was going to surprise you, I think. I think this was the one you might not think I would take at all.
I should have said Molly Miller to Arizona State as well. That's my fault. That's a faux pas. Excuse me, Molly. My apologies. So, sorry, go ahead.
I'm going to go Kelly Harper because if you go back to Missouri State years, she had those guys in the Sweet 16.
Yep.
She's going back to the state of Missouri. She's not going to have the extreme pressure. I thought she did a pretty good job at Tennessee, which had kind of hit the skids before she came in, and she kind of got the ship back and steady again. But I'm going to go with Kelly Harper. I think she has a chance at Missouri, even though it's in a really, really tough SEC women's league. I think she has a chance to do a good job there.
I think she'll do a really good job. I think she did a good job attending. Like you said, Tony, she took over a situation where, yeah, it wasn't good at Tennessee. I mean, it just wasn't. And she did a good job. If she would have been at anywhere other than Tennessee, she'd still be coaching there right now. I mean, without a doubt. But it's Tennessee, you know, and you know, Tennessee women's basketball, Kentucky men's basketball, Nebraska football, really good is not good enough, you know. And we talked about that with Calipari. Calipari was still doing a really, really good job at Kentucky. He just lost games in March, you know, and he had a couple of bad losses, and you know, one bad loss at Kentucky is like four bad losses anywhere else, you know. So, yeah, I like that. I like that pick. I think Darren DeVries is going to do a really good job at Indiana, and that pains me, Tony. It pains me as somebody growing up in Northwest Iowa doing Tom Chambers dunks with the middle part on my Nerf hoop and despising Bobby Knight as a child. I think Darren DeVries might be the best coach that Indiana has brought in since, just pure basketball coach, since Coach Knight left there. That's just my opinion. I think he's had the proper, grooming would be the right word. I mean, he was here in Omaha for a long time, worked under Coach Mack, had success at Drake, did a great job in 1 year at West Virginia. Now, not the cleanest exit.
Not the best exit
from Indiana, from West Virginia, but I think he's got a chance to do a really, really good job.
Yeah, and I agree 100% on the best basketball coach. It's not going to hurt that he's going to have Tucker with him, because obviously Tucker is a pretty good player in his own right. And Marty, one thing I would go back to, Coach McDermott at Creighton, there needs to be more respect on that man's name. He is a really, really good basketball coach. I didn't mention him earlier in our first segment with leaders, but you take a look, they lost, you know, Pop Isaacs, obviously, and some of the things they went through with depending upon, you know, some young guys, inexperienced guys, and to get them where they got them, is just an amazing job by he and his staff, as usual. And that's kind of become the thing where maybe we just always expect it and maybe don't put enough respect and stuff on Coach McDermott's name, but he's really, really good.
To anybody that would listen to me, and there's not that many people who want to listen to me, but I really think this was his best, him and his coaching staff, and that goes down to Coach Vanderloo and Coach Merfeld and Miller, who got the job at Murray State. This was probably their best coaching job. As a complete staff, I basically they had one point guard, and Ashworth's really good. Kalkbrenner, defensive player of the year 4 years in a row in the Big East, but they had basically four fours that they were playing between the 2-3 and the four spot, mm-hmm. and kind of matching it up together and changing some things I think Mac was just unbelievable on the sidelines this year. I thought he did a terrific job. So, coaches, you know just as well as I do that we're always looking for new and different ways to motivate our players and programs. But sometimes it's hard to find that perfect source that we're looking for. Over the past 25 years, I've collected hundreds of handouts to help motivate my players and programs. And now I'd like to share some of my favorites with you. The A Pen and a Napkin 101 Best Handouts booklet is now available to you for only $15. In this booklet, you'll find motivational material for all types of situations and individuals to help you communicate your values to your players and program. For ordering information, you can either DM me on Twitter or email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com for details. Tony, let's talk. Speaking of Arby's, the Boston Celtics have got more than enough Arby's to go around for pretty much everybody at this point.
It's crazy with how much they sold the Celtics for.
Yeah. $6.1 billion. The guy's name, he's like a financial advisor, Bill Chisholm, bought it for $6.1 billion. Just a shade above what the Washington Commanders sold for last year. They don't get the arena, which is pretty crazy. You know, $6 billion and change, but you don't get an arena either. I think probably the most disappointing thing, Tony, is God, we spent a lot of time putting in the pitch and we got third, which is frustrating, but.
You know, $1 billion doesn't buy you what it used to.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I think we should have, when we were in the room with Adam Silver and all the other governors, I think this is probably the negotiating tactic we should have taken.
Unless, of course, you pay me.
$100 billion.
So we should have went with.
That's what we should have done. I am a simple, simple man. I tell you something. So, oh, good stuff here. Good stuff. Tony, who's moving up for you this week?
You know, Marty, I am going to go to the Western Conference of the NBA, and I'm hopping on the Houston Rockets bandwagon as they've won 9 in a row. They are solidly in second place in the West, which I think is a really, really good thing for them, because then you're staying off of having to see Oklahoma City if you can keep winning until the Western Conference Finals. But I am very, very impressed with the Houston Rockets, who have ended up having their fair share of injuries this year, but Ime Udoka is a really, really good basketball.
I love that choice, Tony. They have been hot. They're young. A lot of their important players are all younger players. Now they've got some really important veterans. Steven Adams, who I've always really liked Steven Adams, and I know he doesn't fit the modern stretch five and all that other stuff. That's not necessarily his skill set. But I think he's just a great guy to have on your team. You know, Fred VanVleet, Dylan Brooks has had a resurgence there. But all of those guys are eventually, it's not like their best player is Kobe or Durant or some generational guy. All of these guys that are making all of their money, they're going to cycle that through, and they're going to bring these younger guys through, and hopefully they've learned some things from them. So, or they could take some of these younger players that they have and package them in a trade for some sort of proven commodity to try and help get them over the hump. But I really, really like that pick. I'm going to go kind of along the same lines here, Tony. The Detroit Pistons, I think they won 14 games last year. They are solidly in the sixth spot in the Eastern Conference. Now, I know that's, you know, that's not a huge deal, but to go from 14 wins to 40 wins and to go, I mean, they're not going to be in the play-in unless the bottom falls completely out of the boat here. They are really right there, and Cade Cunningham has been awesome. They've got, again, a couple of other veterans. Malik Beasley has played well for them. This is without Jaden Ivey, who had that tragic injury earlier in the year. They've got a really, really
score at the time.
Yeah. They've got a really, really bright future as well. So that's who I'm up on this week.
All right. The one that I'm down on this week, and I this is hard for me to say, the Miami Heat. You know, they're 1-9 in their last 10. They are sitting in 10th spot, probably going to get in because the Raptors are roughly 6 games behind them with about 11 games left. So they're probably, you know, unless they lose all of the here at the end, and the Raptors have lost 4 in a row, so I think they're probably okay. But it's just not the Heat culture in terms of what we're used to out of them. Now, we'll watch. They'll get hot in the playoffs and make it a few rounds and make me eat my, you know, eat crow. The revenge on this, eat crow on this thing. But yeah, this is not the Heat that we're not the Heat that we're used to.
Yeah, they have finally kind of bottomed out, Tony. And it's hard. I mean, for them to have the sustained success that they have had for as long as they've had it, that's really, really hard to do in pro sports today. You know, teams are a lot smarter than they used to be, and it's just harder to do. So heck of a run for a long, long time, but they are definitely at. They're not even a shell of themselves and the Heat culture. And I don't know if you heard Spoelstra earlier. It was late last week or early this week. He's just fit to be tied. I think they said I was listening to an NBA pod. Eight game losing streak was the longest of his career. Now think about that. In the NBA, for as many years as he has been an NBA coach, and he's got to be upwards of 14, 15 years at the Heat, he's never had an 8-game losing streak. That's That's really, really impressive, Tony. That's really impressive. So I am down, and folks, don't grill me too hard here around our fair city of Omaha. A little bit down on the, I'm down on the Big East. It's on the men's side. Everybody has been eliminated before the second weekend. You know, no UConn, no Creighton, Xavier. The Big East has been completely shut out of the madness here into the Sweet 16, which you know, essentially a basketball conference. That's a tough go. That's a tough go to say this is where we're hanging our hat on is basketball. The Big East just has, did not have a good run through the madness. I can't remember if they got four or five teams in. I think they got five teams in, and none of those five teams are making it to the second weekend. So a down year for the Big East when it comes to the and that swings. There's pendulums that come and go there. You know, the SEC on another up. If I could add another up, looks like they're going to have, let's see here, Auburn, Alabama, Florida, Arkansas, Kentucky, Tennessee, all in. And right now, Ole Miss is up 11 on Iowa State at halftime. So almost half of the Sweet 16 could be SEC teams. So they are flexing their proverbial muscle here, Tony, late in the season, you know. So, but down on the Big East this week.
Yeah, I would have lost money on that if somebody said, hey, what are the odds you think the Big East won't have anybody in the second weekend? I'd have put those extremely low. I really like St. John's. Felt like they were peaking at the right time. But sometimes you can't hide who you are.
Yeah.
And when you're not a great outside shooting team, it may come back to bite you. And obviously it did in a one game winner takes all format with Arkansas.
Well, they went up against a team that was pretty much as athletic as them, but had more basketball skill. And shot it a little bit better, and St. John's had a bad shooting day. And hey, like you said, that's what makes it magical, right, buddy?
Yeah, that's what's the magic of the
chip. So great place to wrap it up on episode 124, Lessons Learned from the NCAA Tournament. Tony, we've got to get back. We've got to watch some crazy endings to some crazy games here. You look, Colorado State must have hit a shot with less than 10 seconds left here to take the lead on Maryland here. So so shout out to my former college buddy, Steve Evans. His son, Kyan, had a great game against Memphis, hit six threes against Memphis. So congratulations, Steve and Stacy, for their son playing really, really well and playing in the madness. It looks like he might be 4 seconds away from playing in the Sweet 16 here. So so happy for them. Happy for you, Tony. Hope the tennis season gets going here and work on the ground strokes and the volleys and the backhands and all those other things, my friend.
That's impressive tennis knowledge you got there, Marty.
Well, you know, it's kind of what I do, you know. I've got my all-white Wimbledons on. I know you can't see it, but I wore that in honor of you, so.
Thank you.
I do what I can, so. All right, great stuff here, episode 124. Hope folks got a lot of good things out of it. Hope you have enjoyed it. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.